Here we are, back in the space that embraces the rational and the logical. It's Nick, this is The Far Middle, episode 167, as we close out that glorious month of July. And happy National Avocado Day, July 31st, constant listeners. So here's a quiz. Is an avocado a fruit or a vegetable? See, I would have said vegetable, and I would be wrong. The avocado is in the fruit family, and what a fruit it is. I love them, especially when the avocado is just ripe enough. Have to catch them on the right day, not too early, not too late. And the mighty avocado helps with improving digestion and managing your blood pressure. It mitigates arthritis, lessens depression, and it tastes great. And a big fan also of avocado toast, one of California cuisine's best specialties. Now, some of you may know an avocado face mask is a popular natural skincare treatment that uses mashed avocados as the primary ingredient because they're rich in beneficial nutrients as well as antioxidants and all kinds of other things. So it's an excellent choice for nourishing and hydrating the face. Now, I've never tried that and I'm not going to. I see the avocado and I want to eat it, not wear it. Anyway, California is the largest producer of avocados in the U.S. So let's get rolling by making a connection to California with our sports dedication. And this goes to the first family of California homegrown sports stars, a brother and sister who grew up in Riverside, California, and who achieved the highest levels in basketball. I'm talking about the Miller siblings, Cheryl and Reggie. Cheryl Miller, the older of the two, was a small forward, averaged over 23 points a game at USC in Los Angeles, and led Team USA to a gold medal in the 1984 Summer Olympics in Los Angeles, coincidentally. Number 31, won two NCAA championships at USC, but injuries to her knee curtailed her professional career thereafter, though she was a TV analyst and WNBA head coach, and was an inaugural member of the Women's Basketball Hall of Fame in the late 1990s. And she's considered one of the greatest women's basketball players ever. And she's a great ambassador for women's basketball. Now, her younger brother, Reggie, went on to play college basketball at USC's crosstown arch rival, UCLA. And he also wore number 31 through his pro career after he was selected by Indiana in the first round of the 87 NBA draft. And when he ended up retiring, he held the NBA record for the most career three-point field goals made overall. Since then, a guy named Steph Curry, who was a prior Far Middle dedication recipient, passed him for career three-pointers along with a few others. Reggie, like his sister, won Olympic gold. He did it in the 1996 Summer Olympics, and his number 31 was retired by the Pacers. And Reggie Miller is clearly the Pacers' greatest player of all time. And once again, following in the footsteps of his sister, Cheryl, Reggie became a TV basketball commentator. It's just weird how similar the Millers' career details are. Both were number 31s. Both had their numbers retired, USC for Cheryl and at the Pacers for Reggie, respectively. Both played college ball at LA schools. Both won Olympic gold and both worked TV. And now both are in halls of fame. Miller family legend has it that Cheryl used to beat Reggie in games of one-on-one prior to his career. And according to Reggie, they quit playing when he could finally block Cheryl's shots. And Reggie credits his signature unorthodox shooting style to his sister in those one-on-one games when he had to develop an arc to make it over his sister's shot blocking. Yes, indeed, our dedication for episode 167 goes to the Millers of Riverside, California. Sister Cheryl and brother Reggie, basketball royalty. This discussion of the Miller siblings got me thinking about a connection to assessing the state of professional athletics today. There's so much debate in the public square about this topic, and I might have a little bit of a different view of this, particularly with respect to how I try to break it down and assess. You see, I categorize professional sports into three broad stakeholder categories. You've got the game itself, you've got the athlete, and then you have the league. And those three groupings, they are not in any way, shape, or form the same story. Now, with respect to the game itself, much has changed from generations ago and even from the games in the big four sports when I was a kid watching them. That's true for hockey, football, baseball, and basketball. hockey went from a much more physical game back in the day to a high-scoring game during the era of Gretzky and Lemieux, back to defensive, low-scoring-minded game. Hello, New Jersey Devils and the Trap, if you guys remember that for you hockey fans, to what it is today with everything from the dynamic McDavids of the league to the relentlessly methodical grind of the Florida Panthers system, which is an approach, by the way, that won a Stanley Cup this year. Pro football, you know, went from an activity that was outright blood sport, predicated on defense and the running game, to the high-flying and exciting back-and-forth drama of today. And baseball evolved from a game that was often pitcher-dominated in the 1960s, to an era of contact hitters and 300 batting averages with the greats like Brett and Rose and Carew and Gwynn, to what we've got today, where everything basically is based on the long ball and bat exit velocity. Heck, you never even see a pitcher toss a complete game these days. And then finally, basketball, much different game as well, with the three-point line being the biggest example of change between then and now, as well as load management, where star players don't play every game. So you may like or have strong dislike for how these games have changed and evolved over the years, but the overall premise of each sport remains substantively the same. It's a different style of, say, basketball for sure, but it is nonetheless still basketball. Now, when you pivot to that second category, the state of today's athlete, a little bit of a different situation there. Much has changed in a generation or two there as well, and the money has gone beyond outrageous, but that's the market. And the massive money, it now puts the athlete in a position where winning might not be as important as personal statistics, and certainly not as important as their personal brand. Thus, you see players today that are running their personal careers as a business more than anything else, and that means that followers on social media, that might be more important to them, to the pro athlete, than games won as a team. And the big contract money coupled with free agency means that players focus on optimizing their earnings value much more than they're going to focus on winning championships and sticking it out to, say, build a winning team. And then you always have the individual personalities of each player. So some you might love, some you might despise. But in the end, talent and ability, they're going to manifest on the field or on the ice or on the court, just like talent always has. But that third category, the leagues, that's where I believe the most change and the most troubling aspects of the current state of professional sports is to be found, and where a lot of everyday people find angst with. And Reggie Miller's NBA is a perfect example. The NBA likes to boast about its commitment to things like equity and inclusion, which is great, until you see the NBA doing everything it can to appease China, which is not a proponent as a nation of equity and inclusion when it comes to Muslims in Xinjiang, Catholics in Beijing, or a host of ethnic minorities across that country. The NBA likes to tout its support of gay rights. Great. But then you see the NBA promote and play games across the Middle East in nations where being gay, it's not just a crime, but the punishment for the crime officially is death. How's that consistent? You see similar behaviors with the other three professional sports leagues, and that's where the biggest issue and problem exists with professional sports today versus back in the day. Leagues today, they virtue signal every chance they get, using their platform, so to speak, to venture way beyond the game itself into social issues and lecture the fan on what is just and what's proper during the game and then after the game. Yet when you see how each league ignores its supposed values to pursue financial interests and the mighty dollar, it creates a cred problem. Each league quickly forgot and jettisons its teachings and preachings to the fan base, and that comes across as incredibly hypocritical and inconsistent. Do you know why? Because it is. Practice what you preach. Speaking of practicing what you preach, it leads us into another connection. This time not with respect to professional sports, but instead with respect to one of the key demographics for the audience of professional sports, which are millennials. There's a new study from McKinsey that blew my mind. It found that 57% of American millennial electric vehicle owners, they say they are likely to switch back to gasoline-powered cars. I read that conclusion from the survey three times to make sure it said what it did. And it's hard to believe because millennials are perhaps one of the most ardent believers in climate alarmism and the need to tackle climate change now. And you'd think, thus, they would be the biggest supporters of EVs because they've been fed the lie that EVs are zero carbon and the myth that electric vehicles are better for the environment than gas-powered cars. But when you start to assess the realities of EV ownership these days, 57% of millennials might be onto something. It appears they are acting rationally, with the majority of millennials thinking twice about the EV ownership and wanting to switch back to gas-powered cars. Let's delve a little deeper as to why. So millennials, and along with a bunch of other EV owners, maybe didn't fully consider the costs and challenges of owning an EV. And once again, part of the blame is because they've been indoctrinated with falsehoods about how electric vehicles are reliable, inconvenient, and cheaper to operate than gasoline-powered cars. But none of that is necessarily true. Insurance for an EV costs significantly more a month than insurance for gasoline-powered cars. Why? Because repair costs and component costs are much higher for EVs than internal combustion engine cars. Studies are showing that it's cheaper to fuel most gasoline-powered cars than it is to charge up electric vehicles. Why is that? Because electricity rates continue to escalate through the roof from policies that are mandating the retirement of cost-effective and reliable forms of electricity, like nuclear and natural gas and coal. And at the same time, those policies are mandating the unreliable and the costly and the intermittent, like wind and solar. Ironically, the policies proffered to tackle climate change by forcing change to the electricity grid are the very same policies and moves that are making electric vehicles more expensive to operate than gasoline-powered cars, thus creating buyer's remorse with millennials. And another hidden cost and serious inconvenience with owning an EV is that a homeowner is going to have to upgrade the electrical wiring of the residence and install a costly charger that's going to add thousands of dollars to the tab of owning an EV. And if you don't have access to a home charger, then you're going to have to use commercial charging stations, and those rates are very expensive, if you're lucky enough to find a commercial charging station and one that works, which is no small task these days. And once you find that charger, it's going to take a long time to power up the EV. It can take more than 10 hours to fully charge a battery, and that's going to crimp your lifestyle, especially for families. And here's another ugly truth surfacing when it comes to electric vehicle ownership. EVs, they lose their resale value more quickly than gasoline-powered cars because the batteries of the EV can degrade or become damaged easily. And the battery is perhaps the biggest cost component of the electric vehicle itself. And that risk hits the resale value of the electric vehicle. Auto analysts are now noting that when it comes to used cars, buyers in that market are not going to pay a premium for EVs, and they're going to view EVs as less valuable and riskier than gasoline-powered cars. The business journalist Alicia Finley did a wonderful job walking through and summarizing these different points about the comparative costs and risks associated with electric vehicle ownership versus gasoline-powered cars for that demographic known as millennials. And those realities and the math associated with them, they do not bode well for the future of EVs when it comes to driving consumers. Because if you can't win over the millennials, you're going to have a very difficult road, pun intended, for widespread EV adoption. Which is why policies today focus more and more on mandating electric vehicles so that consumers have the choice taken away from them. Yes, indeed it appears as if millennials, they're figuring things out as rational human beings when it comes to the truth and the realities and the dollars and cents of electric vehicle ownership, which fits nicely into our next connection, which is how voters are navigating and thinking through what's going on with the term that's been in the news more and more, lawfare, as akin to warfare. I've had a slew of constant listeners asking me to comment on the felonies of President Trump that were handed down by the New York court system earlier this year, early summer. And this involved the hush money incident with the porn star Stormy Daniels. Now, some constant listeners that are asking this are anti-Trumpers, asking to understand how people can still vote for a convicted felon. Other constant listeners who are pro-Trump or asking for thoughts in a discussion on how the system was rigged to wage lawfare and how that represents a threat to our form of Republican democracy. And that's with a small r, not a capital R, as in a political party. And in classic far middle responsiveness to our constant listeners' needs, let's break down what's going on with those guilty verdicts in New York and President Trump. And I'm going to start this conversation like I typically do when it comes to current presidential politics by stating that the quirks of President Trump that might be extremely unlikable to many, they should have nothing to do with what happens in our criminal justice system. You can be loud and brash, at times obnoxious and frankly a jerk, but that does not make you guilty or even more likely to be exposed to criminal indictment. And that shouldn't matter whether you love President Trump or you despise him. At its core, the charges against President Trump in New York are to be kind, highly suspect, and likely were bogus. Hush money payments to Stormy Daniels, they were not illegal, and no one in the legal community disputes that. And documenting those payments as legal fees, now that was indeed a crime. But in New York, that crime is a misdemeanor, and the statute of limitations for that misdemeanor ran out years ago, I believe in 2019. So President Trump couldn't be charged with that. Again, mislabeling the hush money payments as his legal fees. The legal community, they agree on that point as well. So where does this leave us? Well, the falsification of business records goes from a misdemeanor to a felony, which carries a longer 5-year statute of limitations, only when done with the intent to conceal the commission of another crime. Now, this was the pathway that the New York prosecutors became hyper-focused on, because it was the only pathway that they could find a way to charge and indict President Trump. But the prosecutors still needed another crime to make their case. What's unbelievable, to me at least, about the trial was that the indictment handed down by the district attorney didn't specify a single specific crime that was commissioned as a result of the falsification of the business records. That's right. Instead, each juror was allowed to pick from one of any of three theories, meaning that the president might have been convicted by a jury that individually had each juror arrive at the verdict by picking a different crime that was committed by applying a different legal theory. Think about that. The jury may have not had a majority view on a single crime and single theory to find criminal guilt. And instead, the jury may have individually selected different specific potential crimes and individual legal theories associated with them to come up with the verdict of guilty. That is insane and frankly scary for anyone who would be subjected to the same type of process. That's not justice. That's goal seeking, with the goal being a guilty verdict. But it gets worse. As the trial started to reach its conclusion, prosecutors honed in on a New York statute that makes it a crime to attempt to influence an election through unlawful means. That was one of the avenues for indictment and for conviction. And the prosecution's theory was that the hush money payments to Stormy Daniels, and then the labeling them as business expenses or legal fees, they were all designed to hide from voters President Trump's bad acts and poor decision making ahead of the election in 2016. Now, let's assume for the sake of the prosecution and the New York judicial system that he did indeed do that. But there's one detail that makes the whole theory illogical or a non-starter. The payments that were made to the lawyer, Michael Cohen, that were categorized as legal fees, which again is against the law, those were made after the 2016 election, not before it. So to say that the business records crime was done with the intent to influence the outcome of the 2016 election, when in fact the categorization of the payments as legal fees was done after the 2016 election, shows that the conviction of President Trump under such a theory, that's not going to work. And increasingly, there are more and more journalists who are concluding that the conviction is much more of an abuse of a system with the intention of affecting an election, but it being the 2024 election, than what President Trump was convicted of in the New York court system for the 2016 election. The agenda of New York DA Alvin Bragg raises concerns too. He publicly campaigned to hold Mr. Trump and his family accountable. He wasn't so much pursuing the enforcement of law and accountability for particular crimes, but instead he was pursuing a specific individual. An individual, by the way, who was and is running for president. And the judge in that trial, I believe it was Judge Merchan, had some issues of his own when it came to ethics, because he made a contribution to a political group supporting President Biden and opposing President Trump in the 2020 election. And that's a no-no, a big one, under the rules of judicial conduct in New York. At a minimum, the judge should have recused himself from the trial because the appearance and presumption of not being sort of objective and of being biased were shattered. but he didn't recuse himself, and he presided over the conviction, which taints the legitimacy of the conviction further. And by the way, it's only fair to point out that Hillary Clinton did close to the exact same thing that President Trump did with no accountability. Remember, her campaign paid a law firm more than $1 million that was used for payments to a third party to produce what's known as opposition research and what became famously known as the Steele dossier. Those payments were falsely described as legal services and legal consulting, and the Federal Election Commission fined the Clinton campaign $8,000 for the violation, while Hillary Clinton walked away without any repercussion. The payments involved in President Trump and his attorney and the adult film star were smaller, yet the precedent that was followed for Hillary Clinton didn't seem to apply at all when it came to Donald Trump. Different rules and different standards for different people. That's not what you find in stable legal systems. The reason many people, from the pro-Trump crowd, obviously, to the Republicans who even dislike Trump, to independents and even some Democrats, the reason they're all troubled by what happened in the New York court system is that it appears as if it was all done to harm an opposing political party or candidate. That's what you expect to see in banana republics and in places like Russia and in places like Iran or China. A functional, stable Republican democracy, it doesn't do that. Hey, if President Trump committed legitimate crimes, then he should be held to account, pure and simple. But what happened in New York with its criminal justice system, it's not that. And I think objective thinkers can agree on that, no matter what the political affiliations or personal views of the individual known as Donald Trump may be. Let's leave the topic of constant listeners weighing in and asking about thoughts on the New York courts and President Trump's conviction to the next connection, which is the second most popular question of late that I receive from constant listeners and from attendees at speeches. So many a person has pinged me with current thoughts, offering both theirs and asking about mine, on the stock market and current state of investing. In looking at macro data objectively, you have to be a little bit worried as an investor in the stock market these days. I'm sure bargains are to be had with cheap stocks here and there, but generally I see a series of problems in front of us or approaching rapidly. First, the major stock indices, they're near or at all-time highs, and lofty valuations are found across all the major indices. Downside exposure to a correction keeps growing at every fresh record high. Volatility in a market, as measured by the VIX, which is sort of the standard proxy for volatility, it's essentially at 20-year lows. There's no fear in the market, which creates a little bit of fear in me, frankly, because it's always calmness before the storm. And those prior 2 points result in high risk and low potential reward. Today's returns may not come close to compensating for the risk involved, and investing is all about risk and reward. The bond market is skittish, more so than equities. That's what, you know, $35 trillion or so in government debt coupled with zero appetite for balancing budgets spells. It spells basically that coupled with a potential debt crisis coming, and that's going to impact everything else, including stocks. And bigger problems exist with government debt, by the way, in the EU than even here in the United States. France and Italy is 2 examples. They could burn down any day now with regard to their sovereign debt situations. And then the November election, it's going to be contentious, it's going to be close, whatever unfolds, and it's likely to spook markets, not assure them. The Federal Reserve and the European Central Bank, the ECB, they're both stuck with their policies. They need to cut rates to keep debt service costs lower, but inflation isn't going away. Now what do you do? Geopolitics, best word there is scary. It's going to remain so and likely worsen. China, Taiwan, Iran, and the Mideast, Russia, Ukraine, the world could be thrown into crisis from any of those individual conflicts or stressors. Look, I've been wrong about this for a while, so take the view that I just gave you with a big grain of salt. But the worry keeps growing larger by each contributing risk and in the aggregate, and it seems to grow larger every month. I have that sense that the data around us are saying, caveat emptor. And that's fancy Latin, by the way, for buyer beware. And when you invest in the stock market, you are buying a piece of companies. So beware. Time to wrap it up. Now, all the money you make investing will take us into a final connection to celebrate what happened on this air date, July 31st, back in 1792. That's when the cornerstone was laid for the first U.S. government building. What do you think it was? It's where the money you use to invest was and is physically made, the U.S. Mint. Now, what city saw the first mint building? Philadelphia, constant listeners. And the U.S. Mint remains with its presence in Philly to this day, not far from the Liberty Bell. You be sure to keep your presence with this podcast and stay connected to that far middle.